Good evening. Welcome to our second installment of our annual storytelling episodes. I hope you enjoyed Washington Irving's Legend of Sleepy Hollow last week. It isn't a novel, but I thought it might be close enough to take care of the long-form literary ghost story as a genre example. This week we'll be hearing some shorter format tales. In some ways, this will be like episodes from previous Samhain seasons. We'll have a few folk tales focusing on ghastly themes like raising the dead and vengeance from beyond the grave. I hope that in comparison with our other episodes this year, though, this one will provide a good example of how and why short stories work so well for spooky effect. We'll begin with a story called Fear by Ahmed Abdullah, the pen name of Russian writer Alexander Nikolaevich Romanov, a relative of the famous Romanov royals. It contains several horrors, not the least of which is my terrible attempt at a Scottish accent. My apologies to all my listeners, but especially to my Scottish friends, to Scarlett's husband, and to Ms. Graveyard Dirt. It is also not exactly written for a contemporary and progressive audience, but I did not change anything from the version I have for the sake of maintaining fidelity. Next, we'll hear a Russian gypsy story called The Dead Encampment. And following that, we'll hear a Jewish folktale called The Dead Man's Accusation. Finally, we'll finish with the Hopi legend of A Journey to the Skeleton House. All three of these folktales are much shorter than the literary piece, but I think they complement the somewhat culturally insensitive Akbar tale nicely, or perhaps counterbalance it. At any rate, I hope you'll enjoy these stories. At the very least, I hope it shows just how active and energetic the dead can be. A good thought for this time of year. Fear by Ahmed Abdullah. The fact that the man whom he feared had died 10 years earlier did not in the least lessen Stuart McGregor's obsession of horror, of a certain grim expectancy every time he recalled that final scene, just before Farragut Hutchinson disappeared in the African jungle that stood, spectrally motionless, as if forged out of some blackish-green metal, in the haggard moonlight. As he reconstructed it, the whole scene seemed unreal, almost oppressively, ludicrously theatrical. The pall of sodden Stygian darkness all around, the night sounds of soft-winged, obscene things flapping lazily overhead or brushing against the furry trees that held the woolly heat of the tropical day. The slimy, swishy things that glided and crawled and wiggled underfoot. The vibrant growl of a hunting lioness that began in a deep basso and peaked to a shrill, high-pitched, ridiculously inadequate treble. A spotted hyena's vicious, bluffing bark. The chirp and whistle of innumerable monkeys, a warthog, breaking through the undergrowth with a clownish crash, and somewhere, very far away, the staccato thumping of a signal drum, and more faintly yet the answer from the next in line. He had seen many such drums, made from fire-hollow palm trees, and covered with tightly stretched skin, often the skin of a human enemy. Yes, he remembered it all. He remembered the night jungle creeping in on their camp like a sentient, malign being. And then that ghastly, ironic moon squinting down, just as Farragut Hutchison walked away between the 6 giant-plumed, ochre-smeared Bakoto tribesmen, and bringing into crass relief the tattoo mark on the man's back, where the shirt had been torn to tatters by camel thorns, and weight of its spikes and saber-shaped palm leaves. He recalled the occasion when Farragut Hutchison had had himself tattooed. After a crimson, drunken spree at Madame Celeste's place in Port Said, at the other side of the Red Sea Trader's Bazaar, to please a Swahili dancing girl who looked like a golden Madonna of evil, familiar with all seven sins. Doubtless the girl had gone shares with the Levantine craftsmen who had done the work, an eagle in bold and red, surmounted by a lopsided crown, and surrounded by a wavy design. The eagle was in profile, and its single eye had a disconcerting trick of winking sardonically whenever Farragut Hutchison moved his back muscles or twitched his shoulder blades. Always in his memory, Stuart MacGregor saw that tattoo mark. Always did he see the wicked, leering squint in the eagle's eye, and then he would scream, wherever he happened to be, in a theater, a Broadway restaurant, or across some good friend's mahogany and beef. Thinking back, he remembered that for all their bravado, for all their showing off to each other, both he and Farragut Hutchison had been afraid since that day up in the hinterland, when drunk with fermented palm wine, they had insulted the fetish of the Bakotos. While the men were away hunting and none left to guard the village except the women and children and a few feeble old men whose curses and high-pitched maledictions were picturesque, but hardly effectual enough to stop him and his partner from doing a vulgar, intoxicated dance in front of the idol, from grinding burning cigar ends into its squat, repulsive features, and from generally polluting the juju hut, not to speak of the thorough and profitable looting of the place. They had got away with the plunder, gold dust and a handful of splendid canary diamonds, before the Bakoto warriors had returned. But fear had followed them, stalked them, trailed them. A fear different from any they had ever experienced before. And be it mentioned that their path of life had been crimsoned and twisted and fantastic, that they had followed the little squinting, swart-headed, hunchback genie of adventure wherever man's primitive lawlessness rules, from Nome to Timbuktu, from Peru to the black felt tents of Outer Mongolia, from the Australian bush to the absinthe-sodden gangster haunts of Paris. Be it mentioned furthermore that thus often they had stared death in the face and, not being fools, had found the staring distasteful and shivery. But what they had felt on that journey, back to the security of the coast and the ragged Union Jack flapping disconsolately above the British governor's official corrugated iron mansion, had been something worse than mere physical fear. It had been a nameless, brooding, sinister apprehension which had crept through their souls, a harshly discordant note that had pealed through the hidden recesses of their beings. Everything had seemed to mock them. The crawling, sour, miasmic jungle, the slippery roots and timber falls, the sun of the tropics, brown, decayed like the sun on the Day of Judgment. The very flowers, spiky, odorous, waxen, unhealthy, lascivious. At night, when they had rested in some clearing, they had even feared their own campfire, flaring up, twinkling, flickering, and then coiling into a ruby ball. It had seemed completely isolated in the purple night. Isolated! How they had longed for human companionship. European companionship, European faces, European slang, European curses, European odors, European obscenities. Why, they would have welcomed a decent, square, honest, white murder. A knife flashing in some yellow-haired Norse sailor's brawny fist. A belaying pin in the hand of some bullying Liverpool tramp ship skipper. Some gnome gambler's six-gun splattering leaden death. Some thug of the Rue de Venise garroting a passerby. But here, in the African jungle, and how Stuart McGregor remembered it, the fear of death had seemed pregnant with unmentionable horror. There had been no sounds except the buzzing of the tsetse flies and a faint rubbing of drums, whispering through the jungle like the voices of disembodied souls, astray on the outer rim of creation. And overhead, the stars. Always at night, three stars, glittering, leering. And Stuart McGregor, who had gone through college and had once written his college measure of limping, anemic verse, had pointed at them. "The three stars of Africa," he had said. "The star of violence, the star of lust, and the little stinking star of greed." Then had McGregor broken into staccato laughter, which had struck Farragut Hutchison as singularly out of place and caused him to blurt forth with a wicked curse, "Shut your trap, you!" For already they had begun to quarrel. Those two pals of a dozen tight, riotous adventures. Already, imperceptibly, gradually, like the shadow of a leaf through summer dusk, a mutual hatred had grown up between them. But they had controlled themselves. The diamonds were good, could be sold at a big figure, and, even split in two, would mean a comfortable stake. Then, quite suddenly, had come the end for one of them. And the twisting, gliding skill of Stuart McGregor's fingers had made sure that Farragut Hutchison should be that one. Years after, when Africa as a whole had faded to a memory of coiling unclean shadows, Stuart McGregor used to say, with that rather plaintive, monotonous drawl of his, that the end of this phantasmal African adventure had been different from what he had expected it to be. In a way, he had found it disappointing. Not that it had lacked in purely dramatic thrills and blood-curdling trimmings. That wasn't it. On the contrary, it had had a plethora of thrill. But rather, he must have been keyed up to too high a pitch, must have expected too much, feared too much during that journey from the Bokoto village back through the hinterland. Then, one night, the Bokoto warriors had come from nowhere, out of the jungle, hundreds of them, silent, as if the wilderness had spewed them forth. It was all quite prosy. Prosy, too, had been the expectation of death. It had even seemed a welcome relief from the straining fatigues of the jungle pull, the recurrent hits of fever, the flying and crawling pests, the gnawing moroseness which is so typically African. "An explosion of life and hatred," Stuart McGregor used to say. "That's what I had expected, don't you see? Quick and merciless, and it wasn't. For the end came, slow and inevitable, stolid, Greek in a way, and so courtly, so polite. That was the worst of it." For the leader of the Bokotos, a tall, broad, frizzy, odorous warrior, with a face like a native Nero, with a dash of a Manchu emperor, had bowed before them with the great clanking of barbarous ornaments. There had been no marring taint of hatred in his voice as he told them that they must pay for their insults to the fetish. He had not even mentioned the theft of the gold dust and diamonds. "My heart is heavy at the thought, white chiefs," he said, "but you must pay." Stuart McGregor had stammered an ineffectual, foolish apology. We were drunk. We didn't know what you were doing." The Bokoto had finished the sentence for him with a little melancholy sigh. "And there is forgiveness in my heart." "You mean to say..." Farragut Hutchison had jumped up with an extended hand, blurting out a hectic thanks, forgiveness in my heart, not in the Juju's, gently continued the native. For the Juju never forgives. On the other hand, the Juju is fair. He wants his just measure of blood, not an ounce more. Therefore, the Bokoto had gone on, and his face had been as stony and passionless as that of the Buddha who meditates in the shade of the cobra's hood. The choice will be yours. Yes, choose which one of you will die. The Bokoto had smiled, with the same suave courtliness which had somehow increased the utter horror of the scene. Die, oh, a slow death, befitting the insult to the Juju, befitting the Juju's great holiness. Suddenly, Stuart McGregor had understood that there would be no arguing, no bargaining whatsoever. Quickly had come his hysterical question. Who? I? He had slurred and stopped, somehow ashamed. And the Bokoto had finished the interrupted question with a gentle, gliding, inhuman laughter. Your friend? White Chief, that is for you two to decide. I only know that the Juju has spoken to the priest, and that he is satisfied with the life of one of you two. The life and the death. A slow death. He had paused. Then he had continued gently, so very, very gently. Yes, a slow death, depending entirely upon the vitality of the one of you two who will be sacrificed to the Juju. There will be little knives. There will be the flying insects which follow the smell of blood and festering flesh. Two, there will be many crimson-headed ants, many ants, and a thin river of honey to show them the trail. He had yawned, and then he had gone on. Consider, the Juju is just. He only wants the sacrifice of one of you, and you yourselves must decide which one shall go, and which one shall stay. And remember the little knives. Be pleased to remember the many ants which follow the honey trail. I shall return shortly and hear your choice. He had bowed and, with his silent warriors, had stepped back into the jungle that had closed behind them like a curtain. Even in that moment of stark, enormous horror, horror too great to be grasped, horror that swept over and beyond the barriers of fear, even in that moment Stuart McGregor had realized that, by leaving the choice to them, the Bokoto had committed a refined cruelty worthy of a more civilized race, and had added a psychic torture fully as dreadful as the physical torture of the little knives. Two, in that moment of ghastly expectancy, he had known that it was Farragut Hutchison who would be sacrificed to the Juju. Farragut Hutchison, who sat there staring into the campfire, making strange little funny noises in his throat. Suddenly, Stuart McGregor had laughed. He remembered that laugh to his dying day, and had thrown a greasy pack of playing cards into the circle of meager, indifferent light. "Let the cards decide, old boy," he had shouted. "One hand of poker, and no drawing to your hands, show down. That's square, isn't it?" "Sure," the other had replied, still staring straight ahead of him. "Go ahead and deal." His voice had drifted into a mumble, while Stuart McGregor had picked up the deck, had shuffled, slowly, mechanically. As he shuffled, it had seemed to him as if his brain was frantically telegraphing to his fingers, as if all those delicate little nerves that ran from the back of his skull down to his fingertips were throbbing a clicking little chorus. "Do it, Mac! Do it, Mac! Do it, Mac!" with a maddening, syncopated rhythm. He had kept on shuffling, had kept on watching the motions of his fingers, and had seen that his thumb and second finger had shuffled the ace of hearts to the bottom of the deck. Had he done that on purpose? He did not know then. He never found out, though in his memory he lived through the scene 1,000 times. But there were the little knives. There were the ants. There was the honey trail. There was his own hard decision to live. And years earlier, he had been a professional faro dealer at Silver City. Another ace joined the first at the bottom of the deck. The third. The fourth. And then Farragut Hutchison's violent, "Deal, man, deal, you're driving me crazy. Get it over with." The sweat had been pouring from Stuart McGregor's face. His blood had throbbed in his veins. Something like a sledgehammer had drummed at the base of his skull. "Cut, won't you?" he had said, his voice coming as if from very far away. The other had waved a trembling hand. "No, no, deal 'em as they are. You won't cheat me." Stuart McGregor had cleared a little space on the ground with the point of his shoe. He remembered that motion. He remembered how the dead leaves had stirred with a dry, rasping, tragic sound, how something slimy and phosphorus green had squirmed through the tufted jungle grass, how a little furry scorpion had scurried away with a clicking tick-tick-tick. And he had dealt. Mechanically, even as he was watching them, his fingers had given himself 5 cards from the bottom of the deck, 4 aces and a queen of diamonds. And the next second, in answer to Farragut Hutchison's choked, "Showdown! I have 2 pair, kings and jacks!" His own well-simulated shriek of joy and triumph. "I win! I've 4 aces! Every ace in the pack!" And then Farragut Hutchison's weak, ridiculous exclamation. Ridiculous considering the dreadful fate that awaited him. "Gee Whittaker! You're some lucky guy, aren't you, Mac?" At that same moment, the Bokoto chief had stepped out of the jungle, followed by 6 warriors. Then the final scene. That ghastly, ironic moon squinting down, just as Farragut Hutchison had walked away between the giant, plumed, ochre-smeared Bokoto warriors, bringing into stark relief the tattoo mark on his back where the shirt had been torn to tatters. And the leering, evil wink in the eagle's eye as Farragut Hutchison twitched his shoulder blades with absurd, nervous resignation. Stuart McGregor remembered it every day of his life. He spoke of it to many, but only to Father Aloysius O'Donnell, the priest who officiated in the little Gothic church around the corner on 9th Avenue, did he ever tell the whole truth. Did he confess that he had cheated? "Of course I cheated," he said. "Of course!" And with a sort of mocking bravado, "What would you have done, Padre?" The priest, who was old and wise and gentle, thus not at all sure of himself, shook his head. "I don't know," he replied. "I don't know." "Well, I do know. You would have done what I did. You wouldn't have been able to help yourself." Then in a low voice, "And you would have paid. As I pay every day, every minute, every second of my life." "Regret, repentance," murmured the priest, but the other cut him short. "Repentance, nothing. I regret nothing. I repent nothing. I'd do the same tomorrow. It isn't that, what do you call it, sting of conscience that's driving me crazy. It's fear." "Fear of what?" asked Father O'Donnell. "Fear of Farragut Hutchison, who's dead." 10 years ago. And he knew that Farragut Hutchison had died. For not long afterward, a British trader had come upon a certain gruesome but unmistakable remains and had brought the tale to the coast. Yet there was fear in Stuart McGregor's soul, fear worse than the fear of the little knives. Fear of Farragut Hutchison, who was dead? No, he did not believe that the man was dead. He did not believe it, could not believe it. "And even suppose he's dead," he used to say to the priest, "he'll get me. He'll get me as sure as you're born. I saw it in the eye of that eagle. Squinting eye of that infernal tattooed eagle." Then he would turn a grayish yellow and his whole body would tremble with a terrible palsy, and in a sort of whine, which was both ridiculous and pathetic, given his size and his bulk, given the crimson twisted adventures through which he had passed, he would exclaim, "He'll get me! He'll get me! He'll get me even from beyond the grave!" And then Father O'Donnell would cross himself rapidly, just a little guiltily. It is said that there is a morbid curiosity which forces the murderer to view the place of his crime. Some psychic reason of the same kind may have caused Stuart MacGregor to decorate the walls and corners of his sitting room with memories of that Africa which he feared and hated and which daily he was trying to forget. With a shimmering, cruel mass of jungle curios, shamboks and assegais, signal drums and daggers, knobberries and rhino shields and whatnot. Steadily he added to his collection, buying in auction rooms and little shops on the waterfront from sailors and ship pursers and collectors who had duplicates for sale. He had become a well-known figure in the row of antique stores in back of Madison Square Garden, and was so liberal when it came to payment that Morris Newman, who specialized in African curios, would send the pick of all the new stuff he bought in his house. It was on a day in August, one of those tropical New York days when the very birds gasp for air, when orange flaming sun rays drop from the brazen sky like crackling spears and the melting asphalt picks them up again and tosses them high, that Stuart MacGregor, returning from a short walk, found a large, round package in his sitting room. "Mr. Newman sent it," his servant explained. "He said it's a rare curio, and he's sure you'll like it." "All right." The servant bowed, left, and closed the door, while Stuart MacGregor cut the twine, unwrapped the paper, looked. And then, suddenly, he screamed with fear, and just as suddenly, the scream of fear turned into a scream of maniacal joy. For the thing which Newman had sent him was an African signal drum, covered with tightly stretched skin. Human skin. White skin. And square in the center there was a tattoo mark, an eagle in red and blue, surmounted by a lopsided crown and surrounded by a wavy design. Here was the final proof that Farragut Hutchison was dead, that forever he was rid of his fear. In a paroxysm of joy, he picked up the drum and clutched it to his heart. He gave a cry of pain. His lips quivered, frothed. His hands dropped the drum and fanned the air, and he looked at the thing that had fastened itself to his right wrist. It seemed like a short length of rope, grayish in color, spotted with a dull red. Even as Stuart MacGregor dropped to the floor, dying, he knew what had happened. A little venomous snake, an African fur de lance that had been curled up inside the drum, numbed by the cold, had been revived by the splintering heat of New York. Yes, even as he died did he know what had happened. Even as he died, he saw that malign, obscene squint in the eagle's eye. Even as he died, he knew that Farragut Hutchison had killed him from beyond the grave. The Dead Encampment, a Russian Gypsy Folktale. There was once a young horse dealer from a wealthy clan. One time he went to a horse fair, made a tidy sum, and was on his way home when night overtook him. As he was looking for a spot to pitch his tent, he suddenly caught the sound of gypsies singing close by. The voices filled the air like nighttime dew. Heading for the sound, he soon spied a gypsy camp in a clearing by a river. Fires blazed all around, and gypsies were sitting there singing songs. Oh, and what songs they sang! Enough to set you dancing and bring tears to the eye. He tied his horse to some trees within the wood and stood watching the scene. Who were these gypsies? Of what tribe? Curiosity drew him closer and closer to the encampment, but suddenly he stopped, catching his breath. as he saw a beautiful gypsy girl lit up in the fire's glow. So well did she sing and dance that his heart flared up like a bright red flame, and right there he swore he would one day make her his. And when a gypsy makes a vow, he has to keep it. All night long the gypsies danced and sang, yet something made the young gypsy hang back. He did not join them. Just as it grew light, he saw the band disperse among the tents, all the while keeping his eyes on that beautiful gypsy girl. While all was still, he made his way towards her tent, intending to steal her away as the others slept. Creeping up to the tent, he opened the flap, and what a sight met his eyes! On the ground lay row upon row of gypsies, some with no arms, some no legs, others no heads. It was a camp of dead gypsies. For a while he stood rooted to the spot, but as his fear subsided, he set to seeking out the lovely gypsy maid. And there she was at last, sprawled upon the ground, no sign of life, her head, arms, and legs lying apart beside her. Well, a vow's a vow. Dead or alive, she'll be mine, he breathed, even if she does only come alive at night. So he put her pieces into his wagon and drove off with them. All the day he traveled, distancing himself from the dead encampment, and as night descended, the gypsy girl came to life. "Where are you taking me?" she cried. "My brothers will pursue and kill you. Don't you know you cannot hide from the dead? Turn back at once." "Your brothers do not scare me," he said. "I love you. You shall be mine, dead or alive." Hardly had he uttered those words than he heard the pounding of horse hoofs. It was the brothers in pursuit. The poor lad was caught and thrashed within an inch of his life while the sister was carried back to the dead encampment. It was morning when the gypsy regained his senses. He washed his wounds in a nearby stream and ruminated on his fate. "No, I swore I'd make her mine. I must keep my vow," he said. Again he set out in search of the dead band of gypsies, and once more, as soon as the gypsies retired at dawn, he snatched up the pieces of his beloved and rode off swiftly. As soon as night descended, however, events took the same turn. Her brothers took up the chase, beat him black and blue, and took back their sister. "No! You won't shake me off so easily," the gypsy resolved. "Next time I won't take my wagon. I'll make better time." So a third time he carried off the gypsy girl, putting the pieces of her body in the sack and flinging it across his horse. Had his horse matched those of the gypsy brothers, he would have escaped, but the dead riders had enchanted steeds. While the gypsy had to pick his way through the forest, the magic steeds flew straight. While he had to swim rivers, the steeds ran upon the water, and just as morning dawned, the brothers caught the fleeing pair. Yet, this time let him be. "Our sister is not for you," they said. "A dead woman cannot marry a living man, but since you persist, we'll tell you our story. Perhaps you can help us." On our travels, we camped in a hayfield at haymaking time. And in the morning, peasants set upon us with pitchforks, axes, and sickles, all because our horses had spoiled their hayricks. They cut us down, each and every one, and just left us where we lay. That is why our souls now have no rest. If you fetch a priest to bury us properly, we will do you no more harm. He promised to do as the brothers asked, although he did not keep his word completely. The whole camp was buried, and, as was fitting, all except the lovely gypsy maid. She remained in his wagon. When she came to life that night, she was very angry. "What have you done? You did not keep your word to my brothers, so now my soul can never rest, and I must roam the earth forever." And so saying, she faded clean away. As for the young gypsy, he lived just 3 days longer, dying of a broken heart. The Dead Man's Accusation, a German Jewish tale from the 16th century. Two builders were working in the house of a Jew in Regensburg. During their work, they noticed gold and silver in one room, and decided to rob the house when the owner left for synagogue. This they did, and when they had taken everything of value and were about to leave, one of the robbers thought to himself that he would rather not divide the spoils. So he took a hammer and struck his partner from behind, killing him with one blow. Then he grabbed the bag of spoils and ran away, leaving the body behind. When the man returned from the synagogue, he found the body in his house. Then he was very afraid, lest he be accused of having killed him. And that is what happened. When the police were called, they took the Jew into custody. And when the rumor that a Jew had killed a Christian spread among the people, a restless mob formed in front of the house. Learning what had happened, Rabbi Judah the Pious went directly to the mayor of the town and told him it was certain that the man had been killed by his partner, with whom he had worked in the Jew's house. And Rabbi Judah assured the mayor that he could prove what he said was true. He asked the mayor to first give an order that the gates to the city be closed, so that the murderer would not be able to escape, and then to accompany him to the place of the murder. Although skeptical, the mayor agreed to do these things, and after giving the order, he went with him to the house of the Jew, where the body still lay. And a great crowd had gathered. And among them was the murderer himself, who was not afraid of being there because the Jew had been jailed, and there was no one else to recognize him. When they stood in the presence of the body, Rabbi Judah took out of his pocket a tiny scroll, on which he had written the holy name, and he placed it in the dead man's right hand, and closed his cold fingers around it. Rabbi Judah stood back, and the others could see that the body was breathing again, and the man slowly opened his eyes. All those who saw this trembled with fear, for they knew they were witnessing a miracle. Then Rabbi Judah said to the dead man, "Who killed you?" And the man raised his eyes, which were terrible to behold, for he had already glimpsed the punishments of hell. He looked around the room and saw his partner, who was frozen with fear. The dead man said, "There he is! There! That is the one who killed me! He struck me on the head with a hammer!" All at once the murderer tried to run away, but the crowd grabbed him and began to beat him. They were already filled with hatred, and if they could not blame the killing on the Jews, at least they could exact some revenge. So when they finished with him, he was a corpse. The dead man witnessed all this, and saw that his death had been avenged. Then he turned to Rabbi Judah and said, "Free me now of the burden of living, for it is terrible to be brought back from the dead." And Rabbi Judah reached down and took the parchment from the man's hands, and at that instant his body slumped back to the ground. But none of those present ever forgot what they had witnessed. They told it to their children, and it is still spoken of to this day. A Journey to the Skeleton House, a Hopi Legend. Haliksai and Shongopavi were the people who were first living. A curious young man would often sit at the edge of the village, looking at the graveyards. He wondered what became of the dead, if they really continued to live somewhere else. He asked his father, who could tell him very little. His father was the village chief, and he said that he would speak to the other chiefs and to his assistants about it. He asked the village criers whether they knew anything that would help his son. "Yes," they said. "Badger Old Man has the medicine that will answer his questions." So they called Badger Old Man, and when he arrived, they said, "This young man is thinking about the dead, whether they live anywhere. You know about it, and you have medicine that can show him." "Very well," he said. "I'll go and get my medicine." So he went to his house, looked over his medicines, and finally found the right one. "This is it," he said, and he took it to the village chief. "Very well," he said. "Tomorrow put on a white kilt on your son, and then blacken his chin with toho, black shale, and tie a small eagle feather to his forehead. These are the very preparations used for the dead." The next morning they dressed the young man in this way, and Badger Old Man spread the white owa on the floor and told the young man to lie on it. He gave the young man some medicine to eat, and also placed medicine in his ears and on his heart. Then he wrapped him in a robe, whereupon the young man, after moving a little bit, died. "This is the medicine," Badger Old Man said. "If he hears this, he will go far away, but he will also come back again. He wanted to see something and find out something, and with this medicine he will do just that." After the young man had fallen asleep, he saw a path leading westward. It was the road to the skeleton house. This path he followed, and after a while he met a woman sitting by the roadside. "What have you come for?" she asked the young man. "I have come," he replied, "to find out about your life here." "Yes," the other one said. "I didn't follow the straight road. I didn't listen, and now I have to wait here. After a certain number of days I can go on a little, then I can go on again, but it will be a long time before I shall get to the skeleton house." She pointed to an enclosure of sticks, which is all the house and protection she had. From here the path led westward through the large cactus and agave plants, so full that they sometimes hid the way. He finally arrived at the rim of a steep bluff, where a chief was sitting. He was Juanita, and he had a white line around his right eye, and a big horn for a headdress. He also asked the young man why he had come, and the latter told him.
"Very well," the chief said. "Away over there is the house that you are looking for."
But a great deal of smoke in the distance hid the house from the young man's view. The chief spread the young man's kilt on the ground, placed the young man upon it, and lifted it up. Holding it over the precipice, the chief threw it forward, whereupon the kilt carried the young man slowly down, like a giant bird. When he had arrived on the ground below the bluff, he put on his kilt again and proceeded. In the distance, he saw a column of smoke rising. After he had proceeded a distance, he came upon Skeleton Woman, and asked her what the smoke was.
"Some of those who were wicked while they lived in the village were thrown in there," she said. "The bad chiefs send their people over this road, and then they are destroyed. They no longer exist. You must not go there," she added. "Keep on this road and go straight ahead towards Skeleton House."
When at last he arrived at Skeleton House, he did not see anyone except a few children playing there. "Oh," they said, "here a skeleton has come," and by the time he went to the village, all the people, or skeletons rather, living there had heard about him and gathered to stare. "Who are you?" they asked the young man. "I'm the village chief's son. I come from Shongopavi." So they pointed toward the bear clan, saying, "Those are the people that you want to see. They are your ancestors." A skeleton took him over to the house where his clan lived and showed him the ladder that led up into the house. The rungs of the ladder were made from sunflower stems, and the first rung broke as soon as he stepped on it, though the skeletons went up and down the ladder with no trouble. "I shall have to stay down here," he said. "Bring me food and feed me here." So the skeletons brought him some melon, watermelon, and chukuviki. When they saw him eat, they laughed at him. They are lighter than air because they never eat the food, but only its odor or soul. And that is the reason why the clouds into which the dead are transformed are not heavy and can float in the air. The food itself the skeletons threw out behind the houses, which is where they got his meal. When he had finished, they asked him what he had come for. He said, "I was wondering whether skeletons lived somewhere. I told my father I wanted to go and find out, and he dressed me up this way, and Badger Old Man gave me some medicine to make it happen." "So that's what you have come for. Well, look at us." Then they added, "It's not light here. It's not as light as where you live. We actually live poorly here. You cannot stay with us here yet. Your flesh is still strong and salty. You still eat food. We eat only the odor of the food. But when you go back, you must work there for us. Make nakwakwussis for us at the soyal ceremony. These we tie around our foreheads, and they represent dripping rain. We shall work for you here, too. We shall send you rain and crops. You must wrap up in the owa women when they die, and tie the big knotted belt around them, because these owas are not tightly woven. When the skeletons move along on them through the sky as clouds, the thin rain drops through these owas, and the big raindrops fall from the fringes of the big belt. Sometimes you cannot see the clouds distinctly because they are hidden behind these nakwakwussis, just as our faces are hidden behind them.
Looking around, the young man saw some of the skeletons walking around with huge burdens on their backs. These were mealing stones, which they carried by a thin string over the forehead that had cut deeply into the skin. Others carried bundles of cactus on their backs, and as they had no clothes on, the thorns of the cactus hurt them. He was told that some had to submit to such punishments for a certain length of time, then were relieved of them and could go live with the others. At another place in the skeleton house, he saw the chiefs who had been good here in this world, and had made a good road for other people. They had taken their tipones, their protective medicine, and set them up here. And when the people here in the villages have their ceremonies and smoke during those ceremonies, this smoke goes down into the other world, to the tipones, or the mothers, and from there it rises up in the form of clouds. After the young man had seen everything and satisfied his curiosity, he set off to his own village. When he arrived at the steep bluff, he again mounted his kilt, and a slight breeze lifted him up. He met the chief, who told him, "Your father and mother are mourning for you now, so you'd better return home." This was the last person he met on his way back. When he had just about arrived at his house, his body, which was still lying under the covering in the room where he'd fallen asleep, began to move. And just as they joined once more, it came to life again. They removed the covering, and Badger Old Man wiped his body, washed the paint off his face, and discharmed him. Then he sat up. They fed him, and asked him what he had found out. He recounted all of his experiences in detail, the woman with the house of brush, the chief and the flight on the kilt, and all about the skeleton house, the skeletons with heavy burdens of cactus and stones, and even the skeleton's food. "I have seen it all myself now, and I shall remember it. We are living in the light here, they are living in the dark there. No one should desire to go there." Then he told them about the Nakwakwosis and the Bahus. "If we make prayer offerings for them, they will provide rain and crops and food for us. Thus we shall assist each other." "Very well," they said. "Very well, so that is the way." And so they returned to their homes, wiser than before. And from that time, the living and the dead began to work together for the benefit of both. That's it for this evening. I hope your visit with the dead this season is as interesting and exciting as the narratives shared here, though significantly less gruesome and painful than some of these tales. We'll be continuing with another format of storytelling next time, so for now I will leave you, perhaps shivering in the dark, perhaps curled up with a loved one, perhaps trying your best to ignore the gentle scratching noise coming from the attic door. However we leave you, I wish you good night, listeners. Good night.